Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Curzon Film Podcast. This week we'll be discussing British drama Dark River, as well as hearing from its writer and director Clio Barnard. I'm Sam Howlett, and joining me down the river this week are Stephen Ryder.
Hi.
And Kelly Powell.
Hello, Sam.
How are you both?
Down the river.
That was a shocking
fact. Sorry. I had to do something.
Yeah, he does it every time.
So, despite only making three films, Clio Barnard has become one of the most exciting British auteurs working at the moment. Her debut feature film, The Arbor, expertly blurs the lines between fiction and reality, and her sophomore work, 2013's The Selfish Giant, explored the attempts of two young boys to make something of themselves in a harsh, poverty-stricken landscape. For her third film, Barnard has loosely adapted Rose Tremain's novel Trespass, moving the action from mid-century France to present-day North Yorkshire, where Alice, played by Ruth Wilson, returns to her family farm, now run by her brother Joe, following the death of her father, played by Sean Bean in flashbacks. As the two siblings battle over the ownership of the farm, a traumatic history haunts Alice and begins to resurface. I sat down with Clio Barnard last week and we spoke about farming, realism and her work at the University of Kent, which is where I went. Enjoy. So, Clio Barnard, welcome to the Curzon Podcast.
Thank you.
So, we're here to talk about Dark River. So, this has been 5 years since The Selfish Giant?
Yes, five years.
And was this always going to be your next film after The Selfish Giant?
Yes, it was. In fact, the I've been sent the novel before of Trespass, which it's inspired, Dark River, before I made The Selfish Giant.
Okay.
So once I'd finished The Selfish Giant, really I moved onto this.
Okay, and what was it then about this story and about the book that made you think, you know, yes, I have to make this. This will be my next film.
Well, it was really the relationship between the siblings.
Okay.
So in the novel, there's two sets of adult siblings, but it was the adult siblings who became Alice and Joe in Dark River that really kind of captured me.
Yeah.
And in a way, his kind of chaos and aggression and that comes out of him kind of carrying this burden of guilt that doesn't really belong to him, and her kind of lockdown rage, really, those were the things that interested me and captured me, and then him making this sacrifice really for her in order to liberate her.
Okay.
And in some ways, I was almost more interested in him than in her, because I found it so sad that he carried this guilt with him that didn't really belong to him.
Yeah. Okay. It's interesting then, in the past year or so, there have been quite a few of these British films set in like farming communities or more rural areas of Britain, like The Levelling or God's Own Country. I mean, what is it about this environment that you think's really speaking to British filmmakers at the moment?
I think it's to do with the environmental crisis.
Okay.
I think it's about needing to look realistically at nature and what it is and what it means and what we should and shouldn't be doing with it, and how we've abused it in a way, and also how we have a kind of romantic fantasy about it. And I think it's really important that that's challenged. Mm. And I think we've associated realism with urban environments. Mm. And so it's really exciting to me that there's a kind of realism looking at the countryside or not really the countryside, the natural world, in a kind of realistic way.
Okay. I saw in an interview then that so this started for you as a straight adaptation of the novel, mm-hmm. but is it like a producer or a financer told you to make it more you?
Yeah. Financiers. Okay. To make it mine.
Yeah. I mean, what's that feeling like, that someone's giving you more kind of freedom and more trust to say, do what you want with it, don't feel too tied down to anything, you know?
Well, yeah, fantastically liberating and kind of, and simultaneously daunting.
Because it does mark a kind of interesting point of your career, I suppose, that you're giving that freedom and that liberation. I mean, how much attention do you pay to the way audiences or critics kind of view your work and your body of work and view you as this almost an auteur at this point?
I think in some ways you have to kind of try and not think about what other people make of what you do, which is quite hard.
Yeah, definitely.
But because in some ways The Selfish Giant was so different from The Arbor.
Mm.
You know, like conceptually, they were so different, and you know, there's part of me that kind of thought, oh, the people who like The Arbor, they're not going to like this, and the people who like this are not going to like you. And you just have to shut those voices out, really, and follow an impulse, and kind of keep going, with that creative impulse that you have. You need to follow it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And you mentioned earlier this idea of realism. Is mm-hmm. that kind of a field you consider yourself part of, largely?
Well, it's funny with Dark River, because in some ways it's, I don't know, it is realism.
Mm.
But because I tried to do this thing...
Well, there's a lot of pseudo-dream sequences and... fantasies from Ruth Wilson's character's point of view.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're not really meant to be dream sequences or memories. Fantasies. What they're meant to be, very specifically, intrusive memories.
Yeah.
Which work in a really different way from regular memories.
Yeah.
Because
okay.
they're not voluntary.
Right.
They intrude or they trespass. Yeah. And I suppose part of my thinking was that what's is going on in our minds affects profoundly what happens in the real world.
Sure, yeah.
So that was what I was trying to communicate in some way. And also, you know, in a novel, obviously it's really easy to jump around in time and be inside somebody's head. And film, especially realist film, doesn't really lend itself to that.
Okay.
But it's still the stories that we tell ourselves, the things that go on in our kind of internal, that we internalize, especially things that we internalize that can't be spoken about or we've been silenced about or are difficult to talk about, have a huge impact on how people's actions in the real world.
Yeah.
So that's what I was trying to achieve, was kind of some sense of that.
Okay. So in all the three feature films you've made, you've focused on sort of the lives of people from poorer or working class backgrounds, and then a film alike, for example, like Ken Loach, does so with a very political edge, and he's very vocal about how films should have a political stance. I'm curious, do you have the same stance to filmmaking?
I think all films are political, whether they think they are or not.
Right.
And yes, I definitely think that my films are political. I don't think I'm as good at articulating my politics verbally. In a way, Ken Loach is absolutely brilliant at, and so I try and express it through my work.
Yeah.
you know, it's definitely there in The Arbor, it's definitely there in The Selfish Giant, which in some ways is about how destructive an ideology of greed is. And it's also there in Dark River, perhaps, possibly it's too subtle, I'm not really sure. I think sometimes, you know, you have to have this stuff reflected back at you. But it was very important to me that they were tenant farmers and not owner-occupiers. And it was very important to me that the landlord, rather than being landed gentry, which, you know, in that part of Yorkshire, that's it's the land is... big landowners are still are people who've owned the land for, you know, forever, since the Enclosures Act. But also, more recently, you know, the... water authority, which since it's been privatised becomes an asset, so water rather than being a natural resource that belongs to everybody becomes something that's owned for a profit, and the same as the farms, where people who've, you know, worked the land for generations and generations and generations are basically squeezed out as the countryside becomes gentrified. And in a way, what I was trying to do with the film was kind of draw some kind of implied parallel between the exploitation of the land and the exploitation of Alice's body. And also the kind of objectifying of both. That we, you know, that we look at, we want to look at landscape as this beautiful thing. And that that's actually quite destructive, because we're not seeing the reality of it in the same way as her body is seen, you know, she becomes a kind of sexual object in a way for her father, who then coerces his son into seeing her in the same way. So, yeah, there's, to me, it's definitely a political film.
So I went to the University of Kent. Where you are, of course, the reader there. And I know a lot of people that that took Representing Actualities. I just wanted to ask you about how... Can you talk about the sort of the intersection between an active career filmmaker and the kind of the academic side of things, like how those two bodies intersect and relate to each other for you?
That's really interesting about that module, because... there was a huge intersection between the two things when I made The Arbor, because I was, because you know, I guess my research at the time was about documentary and the and the relationship between you know, reality and representation, and in some ways the Arbor came out of teaching that module. So there was a very kind of close intersection at that point. I suppose I've moved away from that more now, and but I value that, because it's a bit of a kind of brain gym. If you know what I mean, which is quite, which, so it's a kind of, it's a good environment in some ways to be thinking. It enables you to think about film in a sort of non-commercial, I suppose, sense, which is not to... Anyway.
I thought you'd be interested to know that a few of your films are now on the modules. I took film criticism in second year, and The Selfish Giant. There was a week on The Selfish Giant, and...
You did film at university?
I did, yeah. And
then, great to see what everybody ends up doing.
And, we studied The Arbor as well for documentary week. Your name is still bandied around a lot. Great. And can you tell us anything about what you're working on next at all?
It's early days, really. It's probably too early days. But, yeah, I've got a kind of a few different things. One which I'm writing. And kind of following a similar process to The Selfish Giant. And other things that I'm working with writers. Which is a kind of quite... I've been doing that as well over the last 5 years, kind of developing things with writers, and that's a collaboration that's quite new to me, because I've always written my own stuff, but I love collaborating, so it's, you know, I'm excited by that. It's something that I'm really enjoying.
Great. Claire Barnett, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Okay.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite
of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So that was Clara Barnard. So I think the first thing to talk about, which is really interesting, is this whole idea of exploring the rural landscape in British cinema that's happening at the moment. And I briefly touched on this with Clio. God's Own Country, The Leveling, to an extent Lady Macbeth as well. Yeah. And now this, all these films looking at the British countryside. What did you guys think about how this film explores that part of Britain?
Well, they're not happy, are they?
In rural Britain.
Which is strange because, I grew up in, it's not as rural as we see in something like Dark River, but I grew up in a fairly rural place and people are kind of happy there. But obviously the landscape in these films now is being used as a metaphor so much. And they're kind of dragging this idea of like isolation and repression from the British landscape. And it's working. Like, these films are doing really, really well.
Yeah.
And I think that it does give directors an opportunity and audiences an opportunity as well to see a side maybe of Britain that we don't get to see often enough.
Kelly, you are not of these shores.
No.
So what is the perception of this part of...
What, in this film particularly or...
Just in general, when you think of the British countryside, like...
It's very endearing.
Yes.
Picturesque, obviously, comes to mind, and nostalgic in a way. I mean, I love it. Like, I've got this sort of fantasy about the British countryside, you know, and I'm always, you know, I want to take road trips. And I don't know if it's going to be like that, but it is captivating in some way. And specifically, like, in contrast to coming from London, just the space and the time to breathe. And I like how this film lets us sit in those quiet moments, I think, you know?
Oh, they're like, the best bits of the film.
Yeah, exactly.
They are the best bits.
Lets you breathe and really, like, the space kind of, you can feel it.
Yeah, the landscape really, like, pulsates a lot. Like, it's got real life to it. And I really enjoyed those moments where you get to just... where there's a focus on machinery and wet grass and kind of that like visceral kind of nature of the countryside. I thought that Barnard does an amazing job of kind of capturing that, which you wouldn't be able to do.
The pacing was very good in this film.
Yeah, oh yeah,
for sure. The pacing was very good.
Yeah. Like I said, it pulsates. It's got life to it, which is excellent, yeah.
Exactly.
I heard the edit actually got changed. Have you heard about this?
I haven't heard this, no.
Yeah, like they had a rough kind of cut of the film that was very, very different from what we got to see, which is fascinating to me.
Narratively,
yeah. But I think Barnard maybe wanted to give more attention to the countryside, more attention to like the landscape of the film,
Which I think this film needs.
Yes.
Yeah.
It does. And I think it works much better for it.
And going back to what Kelly was saying just there, this idea that the British countryside is this kind of dreamlike fantasy. It's a place where people escape the city and escape the urban environments, where you sort of people retire there and you go to. I think here and in God's Own Country, The Leveling, Lady Macbeth, there's this idea that the countryside is tough and raw and brutal. And it does, as you say, is metaphorical for a sort of troubled state of mind in a way. I mean, that's something that, you know, is in some about Wuthering Heights as well. Yeah. But I feel like in the past 10, 20 years, it's kind of died down a bit, whereas now it's really rising up. Interestingly, this was shot by Adriano Goldman, who was the DP on Jane Eyre, the Cary Fukunaga film.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And that has a real sort of connection to the kind of, you know, the sort of soil beneath their feet, the sort of muddy British landscape.
That's a beautifully filmed film. I can definitely see the connection there, actually, yeah.
You mentioned then how the memory plays part in the film, which to me is a really... And in the interview, Barnard says that it's because I asked, well, yeah, as you heard, I asked about how this idea is that sort of fantasy playing into realism. And she says it's not necessarily fantasy, it's intrusive memories. And that's a really nice phrase, I think.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's such a great aspect of the film visually that we have all this like kind of calmness, and like you said, Kelly, like the film having time to breathe. But the way that Barnard cuts it very directly, without kind of any indication that we're about to see a flashback, sometimes, you know, someone will come into the shot that shouldn't be there.
It's
very disorientating, and you really get a feeling that she's like unable to stop these memories from like suddenly
surging
up, and that's all because of the way that Barnard films it. Like it could have been kind of hackneyed, and it could have been obvious. And I think this is something that changed in the edit, because Sean Bean's part is obviously kind of not as big as it was that he first thought it was going to be. And I think the film's all the more better for it, because he exists then as a kind of like
a specter,
a nuisance in a way, but like obviously more than a nuisance.
Yeah, yeah.
But he just turns up at the most kind of like surprising of times. And it's super, super effective in the way that that is portrayed, like with memory. Yeah.
Yeah.
Trauma and.
And I think she's talked a lot about how they. She wanted to show how these two characters, the brother and. What's her name? Sorry? Alice. are both dealing with this trauma in different ways.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, which I thought was great.
Was anyone distracted by Sean Bean?
I was like, oh, hello.
Oh, it's Sean Bean.
I was like, what's he doing here?
It's a strange piece of casting, actually, because he's such really an imposing figure in British kind of culture and British cinema culture, British TV culture.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's something Barnard was going for.
I think it does add to the character in a weird way. It's almost stunt casting.
It really
hits you that's Sean Bean.
Yeah.
And you. If it was just a random guy, you might not have the same. When you first see the, like you're saying, the flashbacks come unexpectedly, very suddenly. Don't outstay their welcome.
Mm-hmm.
If it was just some guy, you might not really pay that much attention.
That's maybe true.
Sean Bean doing? Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's not in it much, and he has, you know, next to no dialogue in the film, but he still seems like a fully realized character, I thought.
Mm.
He's not this kind of ultimate evil.
No.
He is. There's something kind of sort of pathetic about him, rather than domineering or frightening.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'd agree.
Which is
with
all
that.
The more scary.
Yeah,
actually,
I guess it is. Yeah.
And it's almost like, just going back to what we were saying about the landscape. You know, I think she's quite concerned with like breaking that picturesque sort of fantasy view of the countryside, and tying in with what we were saying about, you know, this kind of film being a metaphor, you know, the landscape, the countryside being a metaphor. I read a quote that she said in the Financial Times. Mm-hmm. She quoted this ecologist. His name is Timothy Morton. And the quote she uses, which is, I'll get to my point after this, is she said, putting something called nature on a pedestal and admiring it from afar does for the environment what patriarchy does for the figure of the woman. It's a paradoxical act of sadistic admiration, which I thought was very interesting, and a very interesting read of the film, because basically what she's trying to do is show that, like, the exploitation of the land, you know, and our sort of disconnect from understanding what the countryside is, and like the kind of way of life, you know, and how hard it is, and what people go through to provide, you know, food or whatever it is. Is equivalent to sort of, you know, the exploitation that she undergoes from her father.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting.
Which I thought was an interesting read of the film.
Yeah, for sure.
Gives it more, you know, it's political and it's makes a statement.
Yeah, I mean, maybe the climate that we're in at the moment in terms of kind of like both in terms of class, which I think this film touches upon, and in terms of like gender roles in society, which it also touches upon, are like... maybe why filmmakers are looking more into the countryside at the moment. And I think that her physicality in this film, which we haven't said yet, Ruth Wilson's incredible in this film. It's a real, like, kind of, I don't want to say star-making performance, but it's something that, like, puts her up there maybe as, you know, someone who's going to really break through in the next couple of years. But her physicality in this film is amazing.
Yeah.
Which comes from the fact that Barnard sent them to a farm to work on it, and I think it pays off. Like, she really There's the scene with the sheep.
Yeah, the dipping the sheep, which I had no idea was a thing.
No, me neither.
I don't know why they do it. I'm not sure what it's for.
Probably to keep the wool.
I mean, I'm not a farmer, anyway.
But three
people in the studio in Soho don't know about farming.
But you do. I mean, maybe that's maybe it's good that scene's in there, because whilst you're watching it, you're thinking like, what the hell are these guys doing?
Yeah, exactly. They know what they're doing.
Yeah,
it
seems like
very well.
Yeah, you don't even know if they're doing it well or not.
Oh, brilliant! Brilliant sheep dipping there. But that's the best sheep dipping I've seen on screen.
She. I mean, you can tell that she's done it before, though. Whereas if you know, yeah, you can.
Yeah, she knows what she's doing, man.
She's got this look on her face that she's just kind of tired of it.
Yeah.
Whereas if you bring someone onto set to wrangle a sheep in like the first the first time they've ever done it, that's gonna show.
Yeah.
No, but she seems fairly comfortable around the sheep and around the tools and things like that. And obviously, like, you see her, you see quite a lot of her body, her arms, and they're you know. She's strong. She's not just a strong woman. She's a physically strong person.
She had to be.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that there's that contrast between being physically strong and her being. She's comfortable in her body, but her mind isn't right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's with the haunting of the flashbacks and whatever. And there's a nice juxtaposition there between the strength of her body versus maybe the cracks in her psyche,
as opposed to what we usually get, which is like a non-imposing woman with a strong a strong spine and like the ability to do things that other people can't. This is almost a reversal of that, which is really cool.
Exactly.
And her brother obviously as well is dealing with it very differently.
But he's again
a physically imposing figure.
He is.
This whole cast of characters.
Mark Stanley.
Mm. Yeah, who's again fantastic. Everyone in this movie, I think, really embodies the role that they've been given.
And they feel like real people. They're not archetypes. Like you were saying, Sean Bean. He has this quality that feels like a real. And it makes it more scary.
Yeah.
And Joe's, Mark Stanley's character. Also, you don't trust him. You're like, at one minute you're sympathetic to him, and the next, then you're like, oh, he's coming at her.
I think he's perhaps the more conflicted character.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, Clara Barnett had this great line in her interview, which was that Joe carries a burden of guilt that doesn't belong to him.
Yeah.
That's a really nice way of putting it, that he knew what was happening between Sean Bean's character and Alice. He was in this, and then when Alice left, he was the one that had to stay with the dad for we don't know how many years, but it must have been about 20 odd years.
Yeah. 15, he said. She's been 15. Gone for 15 years.
It was a long time just to be left with Sean Bean.
And I think the neglect that he shows towards the farm as well.
Yeah,
and her does she come back with the? With the idea of rebuilding this farm, or does she come back with the idea of just selling this farm?
No, she wants to rebuild it and get it back to. She says at one stage, which I thought was an interesting line, she wants to get it back to like the efficiency that it was when her mother and grandmother were running the farm.
Which
is an interesting.
Very, very interesting.
Because that's like past generations where, you would think the men are doing
that. Yeah, you're right.
No, I think that. That's a really interesting character trait and a really interesting indication of where they are in their lives, is that he wants to just get rid of this thing. He wants to chop it off and leave it behind, whereas she wants to kind of work through it and turn it around and rebuild, and that's, they're dealing with it in completely different ways.
I think he's holding on to the semblance of like what it was, and he doesn't want things to change, which is the dipping scene was a very interesting power play. Actually she's like, I want to spray them, because that's obviously, she's been working on farms in New Zealand and around the world, and she's kind of with what is working on working farms, and he's very indignant about the fact that he dips the sheep, and he like asserts his dominance, which is not in effect, it's inefficient, but he won that power play, So he wants to hold on to what was and not move forward, which I think, again, comes with the trauma, of now that the father is gone, he's got to face this thing.
Yeah.
He's forced to. They both are.
It's the, she does a great job of kind of making their problems worse once this kind of figure this negative figure in their lives is gone. Like, rather than him ruining their lives whilst he's around, once he goes, they're forced to confront it.
Yeah, exactly.
Because now they have to deal with, like, yeah, they can't run away anymore. Yeah. And I think she does a fantastic job of that, like an absolutely fantastic job.
Yeah, I think what's interesting as well, it's important that they're tenants on the land. They're not owners.
Yes.
And you have
they're fighting over their tenants.
You have these two figures coming in. And one's like this young guy that's like trying to convince them to sell up.
Yeah.
And he's
the land agent.
And the way he wears his boots, his mountain boots, it just looks ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Like he really shouldn't be there.
He really walks into a minefield.
City slicker.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
He's got city hands.
Jaws quite there for anyone that caught that. And I think one of the things I loved best about the film is their battle over the farm. And and so you get the sense that Joe feels like he's one that stuck by the farm, and he was one that cared for the father, even though the father wasn't particularly a nice person, but he looked after the father while he was dying. He's cared for the farm all these years. Whereas Alice, I think there's a sense that she feels she's owed it because of what she went through, in a way.
Mm.
Did you get that?
Definitely. Ownership, I think, is an important thing. I think I read somewhere that, like, ownership is actually a theme. Ownership of the farm or the tenancy agreement or whatever it is, but also ownership of one's body, ownership of the trauma, ownership of, like, what you've gone through, acceptance,
She's mentioned kind of thing. She's mentioned, I think we touched upon it earlier, about how the father objectifies the daughter's body, and then the daughter and the son objectify the land.
Yeah, exactly.
That is really fascinating. You couldn't do that in a film set in the city.
No.
When you get out into the countryside, there's this idea of ownership of the land.
Yeah, like
we spend a lot of time in London, we have ownership of buildings or ownership of rooms. Like
we don't.
No, we certainly don't. But like that's what we come into kind of contact with, like landlords owning buildings.
Yeah.
This is very, very different. This is people owning land.
Yeah.
This is something you can't build more of. It's a very intangible, a very tangible thing, but also in the same way kind of spiritual.
Yeah, it's also owning that identity, this is who I am, in this space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you certainly seem to have that more with with farming land than you do with buildings.
I mean, she ran away from a farm to other farms. Yeah. It's not like she ran away to the city or it's part of who she is. It's part of her identity.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And there are a few scenes where they leave the farm, and Alice goes to sell off some sheep. She goes to a pub. She goes to the Dark River, I guess, of the title. Part of me wished it was all on the farm, because I think the strength of the film is these two, this brother and sister relationship, and going, reliving what they're going through and the battle for the farm. Those are the best scenes, and I felt there's not to say these scenes outside the farm are bad at all. It's just when they leave the farm, you do kind of lose that sense of sort of that energy. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I'd agree. I think that it's it works far more effectively as almost like a chamber piece that's all set on this farm that you can't escape.
Yeah.
Once she kind of steps back into this world, she gets trapped in it. And the scenes away from the farm. I mean, I do like the scene where the guy tries to convince her to take the price of the animals. It's a good scene, but it does, for a moment, take away from the film's kind of constriction.
I do think it lends itself to the pacing, which I think was important, because I think it might have got a bit monotonous that with the flashbacks. I mean, I don't know, I'm speculating, maybe it just gave a little bit of contrast to who she is outside of that, which I think is also important.
I feel personally like maybe Bernard would have liked to make a more experimental film.
You do get that
sense.
But she
was given a lot of freedom.
Yeah.
She was encouraged by the producers and the money men to make it more Barnard-y.
Well, that's the thing. I was thinking about this earlier, that it's like a very strange career kind of trajectory for her to go from something like The Arbor, which was a very experimental, narrative film. It wasn't experimental in the sense that you didn't know what was going on, but she was using a lot of different techniques to kind of get her point across. Whereas this feels a lot more rooted in kind of British melodrama.
I think so.
So, it's by no means a step backwards, but it's certainly like a step to the side.
A step.
Yeah, it's a step. Yeah. It's a step somewhere. The scenes where she does flashback that we discussed earlier remind me quite a lot of Lynn Ramsey's film, which is going to be out soon. Mm-hmm. You Were Never Really Here, which is it takes this idea of like memory and it takes this idea of trauma, and it does it it goes all in.
Yeah.
Bernard didn't go all in because she wanted to tell this story in a kind of clearer way, I think. But Lynn Ramsey's film, on the other hand, really like goes all out, and it's all about it. It's like these scenes, these Ruth Wilson memory scenes, but for the whole movie, you know. And I think that's really interesting that you've got two, you know, women filmmakers both making similar kind of films about trauma and memory.
And so it's adapting a book here.
French book. Yeah.
A French book.
Which you've read, Kelly, I'm sure. No?
Yeah, in French.
But I think people sometimes forget that The Selfish Giant is an adaptation of an Oscar Wilde book. And that they're totally different. And even The Arbor is, you know, it does stick to tell the story of Andrea Dunbar and her children, but it does so in a very unexpected way for a biographical or a documentary film. So what Clara Barnard clearly loves doing is taking existing things and just taking the core sort of thematic elements of them and adapting them to what she finds interesting outside of the source material.
Which is great.
So like Andrea Dunbar, she was clearly interested in the life of Andrea Dunbar, but also interested in the form of documentary and fiction and how those two things blend into each other. And then The Selfish Giant, she's looking at the lives of two young boys in Bradford, which is totally different from the original Selfish Giant book. And again here, that I don't know much about Trespass, but from what I gathered, there's a lot more going on, and she just saw the relationship between a brother and a sister fighting for ownership of something, and thought, that's what I'm interested in. I'm just going to zoom in on that with a magnifying glass and expand it in what I really want to get out from it.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
That's very cool. And I hope she continues to be given the freedom to do that, to be honest.
Yeah.
And it seems as though, you know, the people who are funding these films really like Claire Bernard too. Like, they're giving her the opportunities to make these films in comparison to other, you know, British directors who are struggling at the moment. Like, it's really great that they're giving her this opportunity, and it'll be interesting to see if she does the same thing again with her next film. You know, to adapt something, loosely adapt something, rather than, you know, make it an original kind of work. I can see that becoming a big part of her career, actually. Yeah, really interesting to find out.
Should we talk about the ending, but talk around it as well a little bit, because the ending is explosive, and I feel like it doesn't need to be that melodramatic.
I agree.
It ramps it up quite a bit, and I think the film is so confident just having these two characters talking to each other for most of the part, most of the film. And I think it maybe should have had more confidence in the dialogue and confidence in the actors. It doesn't need to give us a big payoff for anything. I feel like it could end at any point, the film.
Yeah. I think it was, as with a lot of Bernard's work, the ending, the last 10 minutes are exceptionally filmed.
Yes.
Like, there's a lot of, like, really interesting camera work going on there.
Yeah, and especially with the environment.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
How they go really back into nature.
And it gets super, super claustrophobic.
And muddy.
Yeah, and muddy. Again, I liked it. Visually, because of that kind of visceral aspect again, but you're right in that it feels very disconnected from the rest of the film. Did you ask Cleo about that in the interview?
Cleo, sorry.
Because that would have been interesting to know, like, if that ending was always the one that she had in mind.
It'd be interesting, yeah.
Yeah. It was certainly explosive. I'll give them that, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It goes somewhere, yeah. Also, weird point, there are three Game of Thrones actors in this film.
Oh, who are the three?
You gotta work it
out. Oh, Sean Bean.
Yeah.
The guy who plays.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
The son
who plays Gendry.
Gendry.
Who was the last one?
Oh, well, it's Joe.
Yes, I thought so. He's the
Gren.
Brother.
He's Gren from the Night's Watch.
Oh yes.
I don't know Gren. I must admit.
I remember.
He's a brother of the Night's Watch.
Yes. Yeah. I thought he looked familiar. I was like, who's this guy?
Yeah, no, that's...
his accent.
I mean, every single British actor's been in Game of Thrones, so that's not really a big statement.
Yeah, and that cast is only getting bigger.
Yeah.
Or smaller, whichever way you look at it. But
I heard Ruth Wilson compare her... She said she met... When she was researching the role, she met a sheepdog that was really just scared of people and didn't like looking them in the eye.
and she said that she could sense that this dog maybe had a traumatic past life, yeah, or whatever, and she took that into her own performance, this idea of a scared animal that doesn't want to look people in the eye anymore.
You could see that.
Yeah, and
I got
part
that.
Of this idea that Alice is this kind of this scared animal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting because I think you can see that it's not, she doesn't want it. Like, she wants to be, I mean, her natural instinct, like an animal's would be, you know, to instinctively react to a situation. It is kind of like she's confident, you know.
Yeah.
But something happens, like a flashback comes back and throws her, you know, and she does kind of cower back into this small girl that, you know, she was made to feel when she was growing up. So that is an interesting point.
Yeah. Well, like apparently, Bernard made them work with a lot of psychologists as well during the film, so it wasn't just the farm that she sent them to. She actually talked to like a lot of like psychologists about how people react after a long-term trauma,
repressed memories, repressed trauma.
That idea of her taken from this sheepdog's really fascinating.
Any final points before we wrap up on Dark River?
I think that Bernard is going to go more I feel like she's going to go more kind of experimental with her next film,
okay,
and make something that's maybe a little bit outside of the mainstream. And I think that's the direction she should head in, because the moments from this film that that I like the most are those moments.
Yeah.
So I'm really looking forward to seeing what she's got to do next.
Mm-hmm. We're saying this is perhaps her most mainstream film and her biggest film, but it's still like just primarily set on a farm in North Yorkshire. She's still in, you know, in some parameters and has major limitations with the resources she's given. And I think she does incredible things with that, so please do check out Dark River. But if you want to stay home this weekend, you can check out The Ice King, available in Curzon Home Cinema, and from Monday the 26th of February, The Death of Stalin will be on Curzon Home Cinema. Both like Death of Stalin?
Yeah.
I didn't see Death of Stalin, actually.
I'm a huge fan of Death of Stalin.
It was so funny,
yeah,
man.
It's really good.
Yeah, I should see it.
Yeah, big fan. Banned in Russia. So
how surprising.
If you're Russian, hilarious, and can't see it, it's on Curzon Home Cinema. So if you have any thoughts on Dark River, do let us know by emailing podcast@curzon.com, and we can read them out on next week's show. And please leave a review and comment on our channels on iTunes and on Acast, and please subscribe. So it's goodbye from Stephen.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye from Kelly.
Bye.
Goodbye from me. We're off to dip some sheep.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.